So hello and welcome back to this latest episode of PaleoCast. My name's Dave Marshall.
And I'm John Tennant.
How's it going, John?
All right, thanks, Dave. How are you? Are you still on a rig at the moment?
No, I'm in a hotel in Kristiansund, which is in Norway, kind of like a little island town. Just waiting to go back on one of the oil rigs, so I'm not having the best of times.
Oh. What is it you're doing over there?
So I'm doing some micropaleontology offshore. So having had a year off work to do PaleoCast, but now had to get a job again, and just for money, which is unfortunate because I'd quite like to do PaleoCast full time, all the time, but you just can't pay the bills with it. So back to work.
I'm sure our listeners would love it as well if you were full time PaleoCasting. What is it exactly a micropaleontologist does then? I mean, we've had a couple of episodes recently, but what's it like in real life?
As in, what's the job like, or what's life like?
What is it you're doing? So you're on a rig, so obviously it's going to be somewhat oil related.
Yeah.
But what does a micropaleontologist do on a rig?
Well, we did discuss this a little bit in the micropaleontology episode, but it's just looking at foraminifera and other microfossils, diatoms, radiolaria, ostracods, and trying to work out an age for the rocks that the oil rig is drilling through, because it's the above water, you've only got a tiny little hole going down, and the only rocks that you see are ground up into tiny little chippings, and then from that you can't really say too much about the rock, and all the rocks are mixed up with each other. And so the one thing that you can do is look at the fossils within the rocks, and from those you work out how old the rocks are, and then you can give an approximation of how where the oil might be.
Sounds good.
Yeah, it's useful. So I've been out here since the start of May, really. And I think I've had about 1 week at home, which is a bit of a nightmare, but needs must. And so I'm out here working all the time.
Well, your dedication shines through here for PaleoCast, that you're still able to record. I wasn't actually part of the interview. It's just Dave on this one, but we actually have quite a special guest. Dave, who did you manage to snag this time?
Well, I was pretty excited about this one. I couldn't believe that we got him to agree to an interview. We managed to get Richard Forty.
Cool. So for our non-paleo listeners, who is Richard Forty, and why is it such a special case that we managed to snag him?
Well, I should hope that everyone would know Richard Forty. He's a professor at the Natural History Museum and a specialist on trilobites. And he's done quite a lot of media work, in the UK at least, on trilobites, lots of natural history programs, and he knows David Attenborough. I think those two are chums.
Yeah, I saw them talk actually at the Royal Geographic Society. It was a wondrous event. They both just told tales of how they'd explored the world and the history of life together. It was just quite incredible.
Yeah, so it's great to draw on his experience, and it's one of the interviews that I've always had lined out as one that I wanted to do when we started PaleoCast, and so I was pretty happy to actually get it, and it does not disappoint.
All right, well, it sounds spectacular, Dave. I haven't listened to it yet, and I hope that you had a fun time recording it. I'll leave you to it.
So again today I'm in the Natural History Museum, and I'm very pleased to bring Professor Richard Forty to you all. Thank you very much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
So could you give us a brief introduction about yourself, please?
Well, I've been in the Natural History Museum for about 40 years. In fact, I got a job here more or less as I was finishing my PhD, which would be rather unusual these days. And when I was employed here, it was to do research on fossil arthropods and particularly trilobites. And that is what I've been doing over the last number of decades. I've now officially retired, but like most paleontologists, I carry on. In fact,
I've still got my retire.
Exactly. I've still got my old office, and although I'm winding slowly down, or at least I'm winding up in other directions, it's probably more accurate. I still come in here several times a week to finish my work on trilobites.
So, why trilobites?
Well, curiously, you could say fell in love with trilobites at a very early age. And while I was still at school, I started getting interested in fossils. I've always been a natural historian, a general kind of natural historian. But these, for some reason, these particular bugs attracted my interest. I used to, even as a schoolboy, to go off to Wales and collect them. Then I got the chance to go to Spitsbergen with the Cambridge University Spitsbergen expedition, a story I've told at the beginning of a book I wrote some years ago called Life, an Unauthorized Biography. And I finished up with trilobite collections, and my supervisor at Cambridge was the authority on trilobites, Harry Whittington. So it seemed natural enough to do a PhD on these Spitsbergen trilobites, which is what I did as my first published works. By a great stroke of good fortune, a job opened up at the Natural History Museum just about the time I was finishing off my PhD. So as I put it in one of my books, there was a square hole and I was a square peg designed to fit it.
Could you tell us what a trilobite is then?
Well, trilobites, of course, are a kind of arthropod, joint-legged animals, and they have a rather unique exoskeleton in that the dorsal part of the exoskeleton, the back, is calcified.
Right, so that's calcium carbonate,
yes, including the surface of the visual surface of the eye.
Okay.
Which is made of lenses of calcium carbonate in at least most trilobites. But the dorsal, the ventral side, the underside, is which had the legs gills, is not calcified. So the fossils we find are predominantly of the hard parts, the dorsal exoskeleton of the animal, although we do occasionally have some special circumstances, Conservat Lagerstätten, where you find the legs and antennae and so on preserved as well. They were extremely diverse. They survived from very early in the Cambrian to almost the end of the Paleozoic, so they were part of the big extinction at the end of the Permian, during which time they evolved an extraordinary array of designs, hard to beat really in any other group of arthropods with the possible exception of the crustaceans. So they were very, very varied and very successful for a very long time, 300 million years you could say, and then they died out, I regret to say.
Do they have any living relatives at all?
Well, of course they do fit into the great cladogram of arthropod relationships. For a long time, people said that they, or thought that, that their closest relatives were probably living Limulus.
So that's the horseshoe
crab. The horseshoe crab, yes. With which I would probably concur, but there is a school of thought that would prefer to branch them off very, very early in the history of the arthropods, along with a line that includes some of the diplopodes, centipedes, millipedes,
okay,
clade. But I think probably overall the horseshoe crab evidence is still pretty good. They are then a part of a large clade that radiated like so many things in the Cambrian. Many of their relatives are known from only from Cambrian strata and were not calcified. But this particular very successful group persisted and radiated throughout the Cambrian and survived an extinction event at the end of the Ordovician as well to go on and proliferate in the Silurian and Devonian Carboniferous.
So They are thought to be related somewhere in between Limulus, the horseshoe crabs, and the centipedes and millipedes, diplopods. But is their basic biology something that we'd be familiar with, or are they really different to both of these groups?
Well, I mean, those are very different groups anyway. I mean, we know they're marine. I'm sure that they're in their biology, they were not so different from many other marine arthropods. As far as we know, they did the same sort of job that other arthropods have done in the sea. Many of them were benthic, not all. Some of them were swimmers. Some of them were probably scavengers, predators. Some, I'm certain, were particle feeders that grazed sediment on the seafloor. And still others were filter feeders. So they ran the whole gamut of behaviours that, say, crustaceans do today. So, yes, I think one can meaningfully talk about their biology.
So why do we find relatively so many of them as fossils? Do they just preserve better, or was it that there were actually so many more of them than anything else?
Well, they're certainly pretty abundant. So if we'd been around in the Cambrian or Ordovician, I'm sure the sea would have been fairly swarming with them. But, of course, as we know from these Kern-Servet-Lagerstätten, like famously the Burgess Shale, Chenjiang fauna in China, and now others, when you get a whole fauna of arthropods preserved, the trilobites are just one of them, and there are a whole series of other arthropods that were swarming around at the same time. So the short answer to your question is, yes, their record is so good because they were practically uniquely calcified, so they have hard parts that readily preserve in the fossil record. And the hard parts are robust, so that they will survive reworking by currents and other things, which many other more fragile things would not. So they're a suitable case for fossilization.
How many species do you think there actually are?
Well, we don't know exactly. I can tell you that a recent review shows there are more than 5,000 genera.
Right.
That's an awful lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, somebody coined the description the Beatles of the Paleozoic for trilobites, and that's not inappropriate. New ones are being found all the time. There's no hint that we're running out of trilobites. And where you get exceptional preservations like silicification of the hard parts, so you can just throw big lumps of limestone into acid, dissolve out the trilobites, it's amazing there are new things found that have escaped the attention of people who just work with what we call crack-out material, stuff you can bash out with a hammer. So they were very, very varied.
So considering how in some places it's relatively really easy to find them, you just crack them out, as you said, before people knew about paleontology, what did they think trilobites actually were?
Well, the very first description in one of the very early numbers of the Transactions of the Royal Society, Philosophical Transactions, described them as diverse flatfish, thereby getting their affinity remarkably wrong very early on. And some extraordinary very early reconstructions exist. But actually, it was not a long time before, even in the very, very early 19th century, people realized that they were a kind of arthropod because they have the transverse segments of the thorax that is so typical of the arthropodan clade as a whole. That was before their legs had been discovered, of course. They were quite clearly seen to be related to other segmented animals of that kind.
How important are they to our understanding of Paleozoic ecosystems?
Well, they're pretty crucial because they're one of the few organisms that are found in most of the paleomarine, at least, paleo environments. So they're also biogeographically extremely sensitive. So different paleo continents quite often evolved different endemics as well. So if you want to understand what the lower Paleozoic world in particular looked like, trilobites are extremely important for that purpose, to reconstruct ancient continents and indeed to map out ancient environments, because different trilobites lived in different habitats within the marine realm. Some were deep water species, benthics. Others favoured living on carbonate banks. Yet others again became planktonic. So they occupied a tremendous variety of habitats on all the paleocontinents of the time, which is part of the reason for their great diversity, of course.
So if we have a look at the cross-section of an ocean, there's particular different habitats. You could be in shallow waters, in the deeper and continental shelves. So what kind of different habitats did they live in? Was it every single one of them?
Yes, they were very, very widespread, at least at their zenith. So, say, on the North American Olivician continent, they would have, which was at the tropics at the time, the shallowest water trilobites can actually be found between stromatolite heads, which implies that they were very, very shallow indeed, capable of living in that sort of habitat. But there are very few species that were that tolerant and that inshore. As you move out into an open carbonate shelf environment, you'll find different sorts of trilobites again. As you move perhaps onto a reef later in the Olivocene, you've got different sorts of trilobites that seem to favour living in subtidal reef situations. Then you might move out perhaps onto continental slope situation, and there would be trilobites that only live there and don't extend into the shelf. And here perhaps we're going to pick up some of those pelagic ones swimming in the water column as well. Get a bit further, deeper down, and there's another different suite of trilobites. And perhaps there's an anoxic layer there, if there's an oxygen minimum layer hitting the shelf, where you might get some of these specialists for that kind of dysaerobic habitat. And then deeper again, you might become quite well oxygenated, but here you're down into this zone of blind trilobites with perhaps some pelagic ones swimming above. Sometimes the same families can be found through quite a wide spectrum, from relatively shallow to relatively deep, but you'll always get different genera and species living in these different habitats. So if you just top that up, you'll see there's about five different major habitat types, all with their own specialists. So that goes to account for some of the sheer diversity of trilobites, which is something that, when I'm giving a first-year lecture, somebody always asks me that question, why are there so many trilobites? And it's a very simple question to ask, but actually not an easy one to answer. But differentiation to habitats, differentiation within a habitat into different feeding strategies and so on, is one way to answer that question.
So it's that each group of trilobites had their own attempt at doing each of the ecological roles, rather than a particular group of trilobite doing a particular role.
Well, I think some trilobites tended to be, say, mostly predators, some of the larger ones, and other families were probably more confined to other habitats, like trinucleids being suspension feeders, in my view. But there were some larger families that seemed to be able to be a bit of jack of all trades and radiate out into different niches within a given family group. So some families themselves were extraordinarily variable in morphology, let alone the group as a whole. That means that they're quite a challenge to study, because many trilobites seem to enjoy pretending to look like other trilobites to which they weren't really related, which is a very familiar problem in paleontology, problem of homeomorphs, but they're fun to try and unscramble.
You've mentioned about the sheer abundance of trilobites and how they have paleogeographical limits and depth limits as well. So does that make them any good for doing biostratigraphy?
Yes, they're very good for biostratigraphy because they evolve so fast, and some of them at least spread quite widely. I should possibly say that the majority of them are of use within paleocontinents. That is, they tend to spread around one paleocontinent, but not globally, these of the benthic ones. But in the Cambrian, some trilobites are the prime stratigraphic tool for biostratigraphy anyway. The little blind trilobites called agnostids, some people don't think they're trilobites, are claimed to spread at species level very widely and are used extensively in subdividing the Cambrian system. So they are biostratigraphically extremely important, the Cambrian. Less so perhaps in the Ordovician, because by then you have conodonts, which have become much more generally used as graptolites as well, of course. But trilobites are still very useful on a local level. And they seem, where I've run across the two of them together, the trilobites seem to change faster, shall we say, than the conodonts do. So you get a finer level of resolution with trilobites. But they're much harder work, because you've got to go out and whack lots of rock to collect enough to identify them. Whereas I suppose once with a conodont, if it's the right kind of limestone, you just throw some in acid and there you are. But yes, they're pretty good.
Is the paleo environment of any given trilobite worked out from its local environment, what rock it's preserved in, or do they have particular morphological adaptations that suggest that it lives in a certain environment?
Yes, I mean, there is a field component, I'm glad to say, to determining where trilobites lived, what they did. It's because they're found in many different paleo habitats, and you can do that partly from its associated fossils and lithologies and so on. But, of course, particular trilobites also develop particular features that were related to their mode of life and habitat, which provide you with insights into their mode of life. So, for example, quite a number of trilobites became secondarily blind. We think that primitively they had well-developed sight, but there are rather a large number of blind trilobites, and at least a minority of those, one can actually see going blind, if you like. You can see their eyes gradually being lost. Some of these lived almost certainly below the photic zone. So they were living in a depth where, shall we put it, teleologically, they didn't need eyes. And sometimes in those same strata as the ones that are blind, deep water, blind shaley rocks usually, you can find giant-eyed trilobites, like cyclopygids, with huge eyes, with sometimes more than 5,000 lenses on the eye, which were almost certainly living above the bottom as pelagic animals. And it's rather characteristic you get these two combinations together, blind and giant-eyed, what I termed years ago the athaloptic assemblage. And then you get, of course, inner shelf trilobites, some of which are have very, very strong cuticles, quite thick, sometimes covered with tubercles and spines. And certainly in the Ordovician, you can find trilobites in almost intertidal environments. But what you don't find them in ever is apparently in anything that's non-marine.
So in the case with the blind trilobites and the trilobites with big eyes, how do you know that the ones with the big eyes were floating around in the top in the photic zone rather than just having bigger eyes to compensate for the lack of light?
Well, they have a very peculiar distribution that seems to be confined to exterior biofacies. That is, they light the deep water. So some of these things were probably mesopelagic rather than benthic or epipelagic. But we do have other trilobites that are found extremely widely, including in shallow water sediments, and very often following a particular line of latitude, paleolatitude, I should say, around the world, just as some modern phytoplankton, or zooplankton does today, and ostracods, things of that kind, that have a pelagic existence. And a postdoc of mine called Tim McCormack and I did some research on even the structure of the eyes themselves, and found that just by looking at the way the eyes are put together and their numerous tiny lenses, that certain of the trilobites probably lived in dim light situations, such as you'd expect of a mesopelagic trilobite, whereas others lived in bright light situations, which you'd expect of an epipelagic trilobite. So they were probably depth zoned, with different species living shallow, to intermediate depths, all pelagic, and then others again living benthically on the bottom. Benthic trilobites also, if you work out their field of view, which you can do quite easily from the optics of the eye itself, the benthic trilobites tended to have long, thin eyes, curved, that looked predominantly laterally. So when they were on the seafloor, they were looking sideways, really, to see what was coming at them in their own environment. Whereas the pelagic ones had great bulbous eyes that looked in all directions, more or less, as you'd expect, probably. So there's all kinds of morphological differences that kind of tie in with the inferences you can make just from field occurrence.
So just working that one through, the ones that lived on the seafloor had thin eyes that just looked out sideways, because that's all that they'd be
concerned
with.
They were mostly interested in what was living around on the seafloor. So they have the typical kind of lunate, crescent-shaped eyes with a vertical surface facing outwards and looking out along the seafloor. Whereas the pelagic ones have bulbous eyes with lenses facing 360 degrees, and very often huge hypertrophied eyes too. In fact, in one species, the eyes, or one genus, perhaps more than one genus, the eyes actually inflate to a degree that they fuse at the front. So the whole animal becomes like, has like a great headlamp all the way around the front of the animal. So that was an animal probably adapted for looking forward rather carefully. Some of these pelagic, not all of them, but some of them are, trilobites are even streamlined. That is, they have a sort of dolphin-like or dogfish-like projection at the front, nose, if you like, to help their passage through the water. So lots of different kinds of evidence can be brought to bear on these animals.
So what is actually known about the optics of trilobite eyes?
Well, it's quite well known that trilobite eyes, lenses, lenticular surfaces themselves are made of calcite. And that calcite in most trilobite eyes has a particular orientation. The trilobite eyes themselves divide into two major groups. There are some more obscure ones, but two major groups. The holocrural eye is the kind of eye that we'd recognise as an insect eye, looking like an insect eye, with lots and lots of tiny lenses, hexagonal lenses. And the schizochrol eye, with much fewer, rather elaborate-looking biconvex lenses, sometimes separated by little walls. Studies of the holocrol eye long ago revealed that calcium carbonate is arranged in the lenses in a very particular way, with the C-axis normal to the surface of the eye. So light, as you know, calcite has some peculiar properties. One of those properties is that only light passing along the C-axis does so without bending or splitting, I should say properly. So that trilobite filters out light that isn't coming along the C axis of the eye. So another way, which is a long way of saying we can tell where any given lens was looking. So when I say the strip-like eyes of benthic trilobites tended to look laterally over the seafloor, that's actually based on the fact that if you put sum together the direction, facing directions of all the C axes of all the lenses on the eye, they give you coverage sideways on either side of the trilobite. Sometimes, but not very often, crossing at the front, which may imply a certain amount of three-dimensional perception. But mostly they were sensitive to movement. Eyes of that kind are sensitive to small movements. So if something's coming after you or you want to go after something, it's good for that. The majority of trilobite eyes are like that, but one particular group of trilobites, the Phacopida, developed this advanced schizochrol eye in which the lenses become biconvex and very much more elaborate. In fact, Ewan Clarkson and his colleagues were able to show years ago that inside one of these biconvex lenses there was a kind of bowl of high magnesium calcite that corrected for errors in the focal length of the eye, corrected for spherical aberration, among other things. And although that work's been challenged, a young lady in Glasgow has just finished a PhD thesis doing microanalysis crystal by crystal across these fake-opid eyes, and found out that it was actually broadly right, that there is this internal device for sharpening the focus. So these few-lensed eyes were very, very sophisticated, despite their antiquity. They're particularly characteristic of Devonian trilobites overall. We were able to show a year or two ago that some of these eyes achieve a sort of fantastic level of sophistication, to the extent that one species I studied developed a kind of eye shade in order to cut out distracting light coming from above, and had a very carefully crafted, shall we say, visual surface so that it could perceive objects at a distance while simultaneously shading its eyes from extraneous light. And these eyes were also vast on these particular trilobites. So obviously sight was extremely important to these animals, and it gave them the edge over some of their competitors. Sadly, of course, that kind of calcium carbonate eye is a one-off. I don't think it's been... There are some clams and sea urchins that have something that is sort of slightly comparable, but really no animal's done what the trilobites did over the course of the next 250 million years.
Did they have to grow these calcite crystals themselves?
Oh, yes, yes. I mean, they molted. Like every other arthropod, as they grew, they molted. We have a lot of the bits and pieces you find might in fact be cast-offs rather than the actual animal. And then they regrew their calcite skeleton at the next molt to grow when they wanted to get larger. We know their ontogeny. We know they went right back to little tiny larvae about the size of a pinhead, which grew by successive molts to eventually look something like the adult. We know that as these larvae grew, they released thoracic segments, usually one by one, into the thorax, the flexible thorax, until they achieved their adult number, whereupon they still continued to grow in size, but didn't add any more segments. Really rather a lot is known about ontogeny life, individual life stories, as well as about the life story of the group as a whole.
What kind of ecological roles did trilobites have?
Well, I think they did more or less everything that crustaceans do. Some trilobites are noticeably large. There's one that, you know, getting on for a metre long. And most of those that are that size, the sort of 15 centimetres longer and longer ones, had a number of features which suggested to me, and most people I think agree with it, that these were the predatory scavenging type trilobites. They usually have hyperstones, a plate on the underside, just in front of the mouth, which are very, very firmly fixed to the rest of the exoskeleton, so that food can be manipulated against it and then pushed into the mouth. Sometimes these hyperstones, quite often, they develop forks and rasps and all sorts of special structures, which suggest this is right. Most of the larger species of trilobites have this morphology, which, again, is consistent with the idea they had more nutritious food. There are a whole suite of trilobites in which the hyperstome is not rigidly attached on the underside at all, but kind of floats in a rather insignificant way. And these are the ones associated with wandering grazing trails. And they often include quite small trilobites, but in huge numbers in certain localities. So I think they were the vacuum cleaners of the trilobite world. They simply extracted edible particles from sediment. And then there were others again, including the famous trinucleid trilobites, which most people know, with their little medallion-like heads with a punctured border, that probably were filter feeders. Again, quite small.
Is that the Paleontological Association's logo?
Yeah, it's on the front of the palace. It arrived there by accident. It was drawn, that drawing, by a friend of mine, comparable trilobite artist called Keith Ingham. And yes, that's a typical trinucleid. They have a kind of chamber underneath the body cavity into which sediment could be brought into suspension and edible particles extracted therefrom. And there are a whole group of trilobites with that kind of morphology. And then, of course, those could all be benthic ones. And then we've added our pelagic ones, which may well include predators as well as plankton feeders. And you've, apart from possibly parasites, and somebody's made a case even for them, many of the arthropod livings in the sea were carried out by trilobites. And a few years ago, I added to the list, although not everybody believes me, by identifying some specialists for rather peculiar habitats with very, very high hydrogen sulfide content and very low diversity but high numbers of individuals of rather specialised trilobites that I think you can make a case for being the earliest animals we know about that cultivated sulfur bacteria in a sulfur-rich, oxygen-poor environment, which they either harvested or fed on directly, which is actually rather a common habit among extant marine invertebrates. Maybe the trilobites learned the trick first towards the end of the Cambrian.
Quite a lot of trilobites you can see have maybe armed themselves with spines. Why is that?
There are indeed a number of genera that become really quite covered in spikes. And most people would concur that these spikes have a defensive function. What you have to remember also is that the majority of trilobites could also roll up into a ball. And if you are a spiny trilobite with lots of trilobite spines sticking off your back, and remember this is always on the back of the animal, so the delicate underparts would be underneath. If a predator comes along, you're going to want to roll up into a protective stance, and they were quite capable of rolling up just like some side of woodlice. Now, if you have spines running along your dorsum, as you roll up, you turn into something resembling a spiky football, and you become an extremely unpleasant morsel for a predator. And, of course, the effect of long spines is also to increase the effective diameter of the prickly ball. So it has a double effect on any potential predator. Some of these spines are combined with rather thick cuticle as well. So I imagine they were, once enrolled, they were pretty well protected. And some of the most spectacularly spiny of these trilobites have been found and described recently, or comparatively recently, from, say, the Devonian of Morocco. And it's no coincidence, probably, that they evolved at about the same time as the jawed fish were appearing. There were always been nautiloids, which were probably a rather efficient predator, but they too were undergoing irradiation. So I don't think it's too imaginative to suggest that these particular trilobites had particular enemies to contend with. But if they did so, they did so rather successfully, since this, in some ways, is the time of the most diverse morphologies for trilobites, including some really bizarre ones, even if it isn't the time when there were the greatest number of trilobite families, which was during the Ordovician. So probably these bizarre adaptations were in response to particular kinds of threats. So spines were useful, and many of the most popular ones with collectors, and they now begin to fetch high prices, unfortunately, are for these spectacularly spiny ones, which are, of course, quite a challenge to dig out of the rock, you can imagine.
So are there any structures that we don't know the function of on trilobites?
Well, fortunately, there are some mysteries to be answered. The answer to that is yes, plenty. although that doesn't stop people having a guess. My own favourite example is, which I've been studying in the last few years, is a trilobite called Wallisserops, which carries on the front of its head something that looks exactly like the old triton, the three-pronged sort of spear used by Greek gods, but stuck on the front of the head. Well, of course, the trilobite exoskeleton is rigid, so you can't be used as a kind of tool to catch something with, because it simply couldn't be conveyed to the mouth, which is what it would remind you of. It would remind you of some sort of weapon or spear. Well, in fact, when the first one came through the door here at the Natural History Museum, I was so surprised by it, I thought it must be a fake. But then more came through, and it was obviously a real thing. And then, when I got involved with my friend Brian Chatterton with going to Morocco to see how these things occur, we found several other species of also with tridents, but every trident quite different, just to add flavour to the soup. So we had the long one with a long handle, which is the first one we knew, Triphocartus. But then we had one that seemed to have no handle at all, that just came trident straight off the front of the head. And a third one with strange scimitar-like blades that crossed even at the front. So they are very challenging. And whenever I give a public lecture on trilobites, I always show pictures of these things and I invite people to make suggestions. And we've had everything from, some sort of electrical stunning device some sort of secondary sexual feature. Well, if you're going to go for anything, once you've run out of all other explanations, then some sort of secondary sexual character is not a bad idea. So maybe one of these animals attempted to turn over another member of the same species in a trial by strength. I don't know. Another much slightly more modest idea is that they could direct this thing down into the sediment, these tridents, and stir the sediment up, which is often a device used to bring out small worms that have been hiding in it. And then they'd have to run forward quickly and grab it in their mouth parts. Trouble is, unlike many speculations, you can't really test it until you've got a time machine. But whereas the other things I've talked about, like vision, enrollment and so on, are things that are really quite testable and which have quite ready, in many cases, ready living analogies. Even if they're unrelated, you can say, well, you see a structure just like this in some other living animal. So there are still structures that remain that defy our interpretation.
If you want to see Willisserops, it's actually our logo for Paleocast, and we did an episode with Dr. Robert Nell on sexual selection in the fossil record, in which we actually discussed Willisserops and its possible sexual uses. So if you haven't listened to that one yet, please check that one out. Do any trilobites produce trace fossils? Are there any that we can say are produced?
Yes, they're being familiar for a long time, the problem always being that, of course, with trace fossils, you quite often don't find body fossils with them, so the culprit remains uncertain. But there are very consistently associated trace fossils with certain trilobites, and in one or two cases, they've been found on top of them. Trace and trilobite are definitely associated, particularly with a trace called Rusophicus, which is an elliptical trace showing the impressions of the base of the trilobite legs and usually evidence of the external gill branches on the outside, sometimes the impression of the cephalic parts as well. And they're very, very trilobite shaped. I don't think anybody would dispute that the majority of those are trilobites. There's another ploughing trace that's caused some controversy in the past called Crusiana. which forms more or less continuous furrows, produced obviously by forward progression of an animal through sediment, across the sediment surface, presumably in pursuit of processing particles while so doing, that has been quite reliably associated in one or two cases with the makers. And then there are various trails, trains of footprints left behind by a trilobite moving across sediment surface but not ploughing into it or tucking down into it, which is evidence of, well, you could say an arthropod walking across a muddy surface. There are plenty of things that do that. And there are some trilobite traces that seem to be produced by trilobites digging backwards into a sort of burrow to leave the top part of their head with their eyes protruding, perhaps looking out into the marine world around them. So yes, they're quite useful. In fact, if I'm right, I think the predatory trilobites tend to produce the Rusophicus type when they're digging in after a prey item, and the particle eaters tend to produce the Crusiana types. And the filter feeders produce a very particular kind of Rusophicus, looking like a pair of beans, where the sediment has been stirred up into suspension. So yes, the trace fossils can be quite informative. I'm sure will be more so in the future.
Do you ever get any direct evidence of ecological interaction? So kind of like bite marks left on other animals, or indeed bite marks that other animals have left upon trilobites?
Well, that's the latter. There are quite well-documented cases of nibbles out of the sides of trilobites. Some years ago, a claim was made that whatever was doing the nibbling had a particular technique for so doing, because the bite marks were always found in a particular posterior one-side position. So this was a ritualized attack technique. They can heal. If the trilobite is mortally wounded, of course they can heal the next molt, but you nearly always get some terrible disturbance in the segmentation or something that shows you that the animal has actually been damaged. So, yes, trilobites must have had things that predated on them and damaged them. I've already mentioned nautiloids and later fish, but of course things like, now we know about anomalous carids in the Cambrian, well, and they probably carried on to the Ordovician. There were other things that could do trilobites a nasty turn. And presumably Eurypterids were capable of it too, once they'd appeared. So they weren't without enemies. But even so, they were obviously able to keep ahead of their enemies, at least until the Devonian. After the Devonian, they're a little more restricted in the currents. You can't just go to any likely-looking outcrop and find trilobites.
So we seem to have a pretty good picture of what trilobites were and how they were living. Is there much of a future in their research?
Well, that's a sensitive issue, because there are fewer trilobite workers now than there were, well, certainly when I came into the trade. A friend of mine who worked in the museum here used to refer to the palace meetings in those days as the trilobitosphere, because there seemed to be so many papers on trilobites and other arthropods as the Burgess Shale crew were getting going as well. There's still an enormous amount to do. For example, the standard work, the Treatise on Invertebrate Paleontology, which is just the systematics of trilobites, was published in 1959, and only the first volume of what will certainly be a four-volume revision has been published. We need people to take that on. It's an important job, and I'm too old to do it. There are new trilobites still being discovered very regularly, Morocco being the most spectacular example, but there are others around the world. China is really only just now really getting to grips with its trilobite fauna, which, like everything else in China, is pretty immense. That said, there are probably more Chinese trilobite specialists now than anywhere else in the world. There's a decided lack of them in North America at the moment. do with more there. There are great areas that have only been explored in a rather perfunctory way, which really do need proper critical work to be done on them. So I'd say, as with several other fields of paleontology, that there's now more work than workers, and that one hopes that there will be specialists in these particular groups in the next few decades.
A lot of the research, as you said, with trilobites has occurred relatively early in the field of paleontology. So are there new techniques that you can use now to revisit old specimens?
The main discovery, I suppose, that transformed the study of trilobite hard part morphology, at least, was the discovery of silicified trilobites. Now, that's not new, but processing huge quantities of rock has revealed the true extent and diversity of trilobite faunas, where you're lucky enough to have silicified specimens. They're not common, though. They tend to be in certain sort of shelf situations that things were silicified. So there's huge amounts you can get of statistical data, which hasn't really been mined for what it can do. I think we've got a pretty good handle now on paleogeography, although there are, of course, always refinements. But there was quite an exciting time during the 70s and 80s where we were kind of putting the continents and the Ordovician together using trilobites. Which brings us, of course, to the soft parts, so the discovery of places where we might get the limbs preserved. They're very few and far between. So we know a very small minority of trilobite limbs. And actually, because of the way these things tend to be preserved, they're mostly preserved from certain kinds of habitats, particularly deep water ones where, for example, pyrite can come in at an early stage, cover the limbs. But there are new and rather exciting possibilities with places such as the Herefordshire Conservat Lagerstätte, where you've got 3D material, not flattened as it usually is in shale. And one hopes that when trilobites from those are worked up, we'll have a bit of a quantum leap in understanding fine details of their anatomy. So the short answer is yes, there's still plenty of new things to find out. Not enough people to do it.
Have you got a favourite specific taxon or any specimen that you personally found yourself?
I think the one way back when I was very young, I discovered my first new genus, so I call it, which was the first of these very peculiar, highly adapted pelagic trilobites. And I called it Opiputa in a very early paper of mine in paleontology. So it's got a strong connection to the Palas. Little did I know when I coined that name that somebody in Argentina was describing a lizard. And of all the names in all the universe, he chose the same name, Opiputa. I discovered this after some 30 years when I had to rename it Opiputarella, so as not to have a duplication of name. But it still remains one of my favourite trilobites because it was. I can still remember my pleasure at discovering a whole one when previously I'd had only tantalising bits. And one day up in the Arctic island of Spitsbergen, there was what must be an articulated one sitting just waiting to be extracted from the rock. That was a good moment.
So everything?
That'll do you, I think.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks for that, Dave. That was a really fascinating interview. Richard sounded like a lovely chap as well. I learned quite a lot about trilobites, and I hope our listeners were entertained and informed. So for all the images accompanying this episode, just go to our website, and it's the latest episode, and there's plenty of accompanying images and text to go along with this. To keep up to date, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, And you can also follow us on Twitter at Paleocast. And we're also on Facebook at facebook.com/Paleocast. Thanks for listening. And we hope to see you next time.
Cool. See you then.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with John Tennant and Joe Keating. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association. Music was supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
John, I've got a little anecdote for you.
Oh, God.
It's what happened on the oil rig.
Okay.
It was both my greatest day and my worst day. So, yeah, I was showing the geologist who was offshore with us, working alongside me, some of the pictures of foraminifera and all the microfossils that we had. That we had for the micropaleontology episode. And I pulled up the website and he was like, oh, Paleocast, I know these guys. And my little head was just like, oh my God, I'm famous. I'm finally famous. I made it the big time. And he was saying, oh yes, I've seen this. Who's it with? And he's trying to remember it, and I was just sat there, and offshore you've got these boiler suits with your name on it, and he knew my name anyway, and I was like, oh, it's only going to be he's going to realise, and it'll be my moment of glory where I've met someone in the real world who's a Paleocast fan. And so I was kind of sat there and kind of moved a little bit, so my Dave Marshall name tag was out there so you could see it, and on the website, it had the micropaleontology episode by Dave Marshall written down there. And I was just like, oh, he's going to see it. And it's just like, oh, yeah, Paleocast. It's, who does it? John Tennant. And he built me up so high, only to fall so low.
That's such a good anecdote. I just imagine you like puffing up your chest and be like,
yeah, it's me.
That is brilliant. And I'd just love to have seen your face.
Yeah.
As you lit up and then got shot down.
Yeah, so join us next time where the world famous John Tennant will be leading us on another trip through the world of paleontology.